Voice and an acoustic guitar for the drummer to drum to?
No, the demos were done. I wasn't there for the demo. I was only there for a couple of the demos. The demos were done with Mutt.
So, because it was Mutt and it came from his studio, were there bits of that that you could use? Or
no.
Did you start from scratch? Well, I'm trying to get to the first piece of instrumentation that got put laid down in your sessions. What was the reference point? Because a lot of bands, you've just got
program,
an acoustic guitar program, and a voice.
Program drums with guitars and bass. The first year of the album we were working on, and the band had done an endorsement deal with Randall Guitars, guitar amps. And at the end of the first year, we had a kind of pause. It was like, wow. And I think one night someone sat and listened to Hysteria and they go, wow, it's great, isn't it? It sounds, there's a different sort of... And Mike said, so what amps are you using on Hysteria? And they said, oh, we used the Rockman and the Rockbox, which is a John Hornby Skew's copy of a Rockman. And so we used those two pretty much for the whole album. They said, so you didn't use the Randall? No, I didn't use the Randall. We spent a year recording the Randall, and you're saying it doesn't sound like Def Leppard. Should we do those again then? So in fact, the guitars that were kept from that year were the stuff Steve had done, because he died within 6 months. So yeah, and that was weird. That's very weird when you're you know, in this fantasy world of the studio, and you put the tape on and you put the fader up, and there's a guitar solo by someone who's no longer with you. Yeah, not good.
Sounds like you did well to come out the other end relatively unscathed.
I was waking up. Mike didn't. Mike, it took a toll on Mike, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think he did recover, I guess, eventually. But it was a really tough album. At the end of the album, I remember Rick, the drummer, saying, "You're like Teflon, Pete." You know, it's like, oh, redo the guitars. Yeah, yeah. Well, just the year's guitars. Yeah, why not? That'd be a lot.
But that's a level of patience that is ludicrous.
So Def Leppard, the first time I did Adrenalize, had Let's Get Rocked on it, which was a hit, but it came out, it took 3.5 years, and by the time it came out, Nirvana and Pearl Jam had kind of kicked in, and Def Leppard were the 80s, and suddenly the 90s were sounding very different, and the band kind of took stock, said, okay, well, let's put out a B-side album, which is called Retroactive. And during Adrenalize, Mike had a pregnant wife, so he was going back to London, where his wife was living, for the weekends. So at the weekends, I'd say, let's do B-sides. And so we used to just do B-sides all the time. At the time, record labels needed 3 B-sides in every song, because it was CD singles. And you'd have, there was a song called Tonight on Adrenalize that was brilliant. Took forever to record. It probably took about 6 months to record, because there was this guitar riff at the beginning. First of all, it was an acoustic, I think, and then we'd do it with an electric. But each time we'd track it up, so there'd be 2 of them, and we'd record it, and then we'd chop up the parts and program it so that it was... And this was programming not with Pro Tools, this was back in the day with S1000s and Akai's and Notator on an Atari computer. Anyway, we would program it, and it would take a day to record the part, and then record the other part, track it up, program it, put it back in time. And we did that with an acoustic, with an electric, doing a kind of rocky sound, then a Rockman sound, and then maybe 7 guitar parts doing the same part. And when Mark Langer was living in England, he'd co-written the songs, and Mike would be going, oh, hope Mark likes this, you know. And so Mark, who produced Hysteria, and so we'd send a DAT over, DAT was the format at the time, and we'd be waiting for a day for the phone call, and Mark would ring up and say, yeah, that sounds like a guitar. That was 2 months' work. Anyway, so that song came out as a single, and the B-sides were 3 songs we'd done as fun demos, and one was Miss You in a Heartbeat, one was Two Steps Behind, and one was Action. Well, Action was a top 10 hit later on the B-side album, a top 10 hit in the UK. And Two Steps Behind was top 10 in America because it was on a movie soundtrack. And Missing a Heartbeat was number 2 in Canada. So the B-sides did substantially better than the A-side that was like shitting a grand piano in the recording.
So is that the old thing of trying too hard and when you decide to have a bit of fun and... Even though one of them took 6 months to get 8 guitar parts right, but you're mucking around more, so it's more spontaneous, there's less angst.
Yeah, you need both, you see. Anyone I work with now would say that I spend hours sitting there going, no, and locked in a room on my own trying to make it sound great. So it's, yeah. And also, when we did the B-side album, which I was co-producing with the band, I was on a mission to make it good. I remember Action, the first single we had, I was like, this is going to be a hit. And working on it like crazy. And it is, it sounds good for a cover of a sweet song. So you think you take another piece of me to satisfy your intellectual So where were we? Adrenalize. So Adrenalize took 3.5 years. Then I did the B-side album, which was fun. And basically, I had 3 weeks with the band to tart up songs that were a bit ropey, redo drum parts, redo the odd bit of vocal. And we put out this album, Retroactive, and it did okay. It did great. And as I say, we had sort of singles all over the world. It was really good. And then the band said, okay, we're not going to continue as we are. Let's do a new album. Let's not do the old Def Leppard. Let's do something fresh. And so that was an album called Slang, 1995. And I produced it. And the band wanted to do it in... By now, they had studios in their houses. And should it be Dublin? Should it be LA? Should it be, you know, whose house? And I said, well, how about we do it somewhere completely neutral, somewhere different? So we found a villa in Puerto Banús. This is... early days of Puerto Banús, and we did it there, and it was a blast, and it was fun, and it was like, okay, let's listen to the current music, because everything had changed. It was Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Stone Temple Pilots, all these bands. Let's just enjoy that music and do demos at home. They all have their home studios, and I actually had a great time flying around the world, going to their home studios, setting them up, saying, well, this is how you do that, and then we all reconvened in Puerto Banús and recorded that album, and it was great. We did it. The idea was to do it on ADATs. This is all technical and boring, not for your audience, but still. Remember ADATs?
No.
ADATs were 8-track digital recorders that cost about $2,000, and you could have 4 of them hooked up together with a box. It was called a BRC, and this box was a remote control, and it made them all synchronised. Except every so often, they were all recording on videotape. They'd kind of crap out. The heads would get dirty, and it would say, no foe. And you'd have to stop. Now, I had the band playing live for the first time in years. Actually, all of them playing live. Rick playing drums, absolutely great. And I'd look up, we'd do the first take, and it's like, yeah, the first take, great. Change that part there, second chorus, do this. Right, second take. The band, Rick was in another room doing the drums, but literally, guide vocal right in front of me, 2 guitars. It was great. It was really real. But I'd look up for the second take as we're about to get the perfect performance and see 2 of the ADAT machines said, no foe. It's like, just the same goes. Luckily, we had 8 of them, so I could slot 2 in. But the whole point was that we'd record it completely vibey and fun. Pro Tools had arrived by this stage. We'd do 3 months of recording, I can't remember how long, in Spain, and then fly back to Dublin, and I would sit in the studio in Dublin, me and Sav, the bass player, and put it in Pro Tools and just go through and do a bit of the microscope thing and get the best takes and stuff. So, got to Dublin, all great. On the back of this BRC, there was a little coaxial output that said 48 kilohertz, you know, which was the clock. You needed this clock to get it to sync up with Pro Tools. Got to Dublin, didn't work. So I ring ADAT in LA and they go, yeah, that isn't, that facility is not in the current system. So, but it says 48 kilohertz, and yeah, it doesn't work. It's like, what? I had, you know, a crate of tapes that we'd recorded that needed sorting out because I'd been going, it's fine, let's do another one, you know, and all the errors. So they said there was a software update coming out, but that wouldn't address the issue. So the software update came out and it did address the issue. And it then emerged that Alesius, who made the system, didn't actually write their own software. So it worked, thank God.
And thank God for that. Yeah. Otherwise, gems would have been lost.
Well, they would have been slightly less polished gems. So we did, and then we went back to Dublin, to Spain, and did more after, you know, more recording. It was great. It was a really fun album to do. And bonding, it was a good time. Yeah. And then after that, did Slang, then did Euphoria, then did another album, which was, and Euphoria was like more Def Leppard-y. Actually, it's a great album. There's stuff on there. There's a song called Paper Sun. We, you know, we're going to town on the big Def Leppard backing vocal sound, which on Slang we hadn't done. But, you know, the sound, which people, before I worked with them, they'd say, oh yeah, yeah, that's just like double tracked backing vocals and then you put an aphex or an exciter on it. It's like, no. Because you know, the band would record three of them singing the main backing vocal part. So each one doing maybe 20 tracks. So that's 60 tracks of the main backing vocal part. And then there'd be a harmony above that with two of them singing it, 20 tracks each. And another harmony above that with two of them singing it, 20 tracks each. And then a low harmony with them. So you're getting hundreds of tracks of vocals, which would take 4 days on trying to think which album. Joe McDonald was engineering upstairs. We had two rooms in Dublin and Joe McDonald would record it, or Ronan McHugh, who now produces them. And they'd be upstairs recording these backing vocals and it'd be like, wow, sounds amazing, sounds really good. And then one of the band would go, do you think the lyric could be slightly different on the chord? And you're like, no.
Can we redo 80 yeah. vocal parts yeah. because we've changed a word?
80? 300?
Oh my God.
Yeah, so that would happen quite often. But it would always get better. If it gets better, then it's fine.
Nowadays, with all the tools you've got, would you still...
It's a lot easier.
...record it? It's easier to record it? Or, I mean, if you wanted to create the same effect now, could you just record it 20?
You've still got to do it.
And
it's also
multiply it.
It's also, people think, oh, you just sing the backing vocals. But no, with Def Leppard, their sound was Phil, who's an amazing... All the band are amazing singers. So Phil and Viv and Sav would sing full voice, really hard, really high parts. It wasn't all sort of sing it very gently and then track it up. It's really full on, and then you get that sound. When we were mastering Euphoria, we were running this song Paper Sun, and Bob Ludwig was mastering it, and he stopped the tape, turned to me and said, got a pad of paper and a pen, and said, now, what is the Def Leppard backing vocal sound? And it's like, well, it's
okay,
great.
Because he heard it and wanted to know how.
Well, he'd mastered all the great records, Pyromania, Hysteria, and obviously people had said to him, wow, you did Def Leppard, you know, what is that backing vocal sound? He just wanted to know exactly what it was. It was great. I had a thing about Slang I was going to say that was funny. Oh yeah, Slang. So the album in Spain, we turned up and, you know, the band were flying around the world. Some lived in LA, some in Ireland, so there was a lot of coming and going to do that record. When we turned up in Spain, they'd all rented cars. And I it was my first gig as a proper producer. I was like, guys, budget, what are you doing? So they all were downgraded to Renault Twingos. So, so we had, on a Friday night, Def Leppard would turn up in Puerto Banús in their little green Twingos. We have actually a photo somewhere of the band standing on the cars like surfboards, which is great. So, and anyway, that album, it came in, this is a fact you would never get nowadays, $2 million under budget. So, yeah, did good on that one for the cost.
Good grief. Yeah. Well, can I ask what the budget was?
$3 million.
So, and you did it for $1 million?
Yeah. Which seems expensive, but it really wasn't, considering it took a year and a bit and it was everyone flying around the world the whole time. But we did it also in Joe's house. At, you know, lots of the work was done there. So during Slang, we worked on Slang and we're doing this new record in Spain, and the record company said, guys, we've decided to put out a greatest hits album at Christmas and we need one more song. And we'd gone through, we'd been listening to all these songs, you know, and the new stuff off Slang was very different. It's more, you know, edgy and cool, in inverted commas. So they said, have you got anything in the vault, anything that's, you know, kicking around that we could use? And we said, yeah. We had this song, When Love and Hate Collide, that they'd written for before and was just like a classic Def Leppard ballad. Anyway, record company guy goes, wow, that's perfect. Fantastic. Oh, yeah, great. He said, the only thing is, we need it in 10 days to get it released for Christmas. I said, all right, it's a little bit of a big ask for Def Leppard.
So there was nothing recorded, it was just demo at that stage?
There was a demo in Dublin that we asked, I think the tapes came out. Hmm. So we were in Phil's house in LA and we had to do this song, we did it in 14 days I think in the end, including an orchestra, which was, yeah, that was good. And basically what I did was I said, look, we're downstairs in this house and we'll do the track downstairs, and we were using ADAT still, so I said, Joe, you're going to have to sing this upstairs on your own. So I'll give you an ADAT machine and a tape, and there'll be two tracks on that tape with the music and the rest is blank, and you just sing all your stuff and then in the morning give it to me or leave it for me, and I'll bounce it all down, sort it all out, and tell you which bits need to be resung, what back and forth, you know. So I put him in the walk-in wardrobe in Phil's bedroom, and it was, you know, lovely, bassy walk-in wardrobe with clothes everywhere, and it was great. It was perfect. It had a microphone, headphones, ADAT, we're off. And he starts singing day one. Great. We're getting there. We're worried about the time. We're getting the guitars done. Got the bass done. It's all fantastic. Joe's up there going, yeah, I'm beginning to nail this. And then I think on the fourth day, he walked into the walk-in wardrobe. And it was empty. All the clothes had gone. It was like... so it's like... Ah! And Phil was going through a divorce at the time. And his ex-wife had taken all her clothes. So he's like, what do we do? What do you want to time? Panic. So we had to fill it up with Phil's clothes to make it sound okay.
And that seriously affected, I suppose.
Oh, it's just ridiculous difference. It was...
Really?
Yeah, it was a completely dead room. And then suddenly it became a sort of rectangular box that was liver than live. And it wouldn't have helped. especially trying to drop in words and bits. Anyway, so yeah, so we got that done in 2 weeks, and then the band flew back to England to the sales conference they're having in Brighton, played it, and it was number two, and the album was huge, so it's good.
Instead of slamming down the phone, girl, for the 100th time, I got your number on my wall, but I ain't gonna make that call. When divided we stand, baby, united we fall. Got the time, got a chance, gonna make it. Got my hand.
Even though you use computers now, it is quite hard to make an amazing record. If it was a doddle, everyone would do it. You know, great. There are still amazing records coming out, and they're hard.
Do you think it's possible? I'm just, this has come into the top of my head, to have a hit song badly produced, therefore no longer become a hit.
It's terrible to say, but I don't think it matters at all. I love great sounding records, whether it's September by Earth, Wind and Fire or it's The Middle by Zedd. Mm. You know, a record that sounds incredible is fantastic. But there are records that are hits that really don't sound great. I won't mention them now.
But is that from a... Are there records that aren't particularly good songs, but you love the production? When you say really well-made records, are we talking about...
It's everything,
isn't
it?
The musicianship, the melody, the lyrics, or are you... from coming at it from an engineering perspective.
It's just the excitement of a record when you hear it and you go, wow, what's this?
Yeah.
You know, I remember sitting, having lunch with Def Leppard in doing one of our albums, I don't know what year it was, 1998, and we're having lunch and there's music on really quietly and we're all eating, chatting, and we then all realise we're all completely silent, and after 3 minutes we go, what the heck was that? And it was the first time we'd heard Hit Me One More Time by Britney Spears. It was like, wow. And that was before the video, before anything. It was just an incredible record. And it's very easy to go, oh, it's the marketing, it's because she wore a short skirt. No, it was Max Martin's a genius.
I mean, that expanded it. It would be interesting if she hadn't done the schoolgirl uniform video, how long it would have taken for the song to catch on just purely on airplay. But, I mean, that was one of the first instances where the visual really pushed the record. And then
Freddie Mercury would disagree. Scaramouche.
Yes, Bohemian Rhapsody. Yes.
Well, yeah. No, I know. It was clever marketing, but it just is a great record as well. I remember talking to Mike Chipley and saying, okay, so you're really, you know your stuff, you've got amazing ears, which of the top 10 in America are digital recordings and which ones are analog? You know, you can't really if people like me and him and people who spend our lives listening to music can't tell, you just go, well, it's a great record or it's not, then there's a lot of fandango that goes on in the studio. But it's more about the performance. You know, Mark Langer, it's about the performance. It's not about whether it's amazing bits of cable that are oxygen-free, that are all full bandwidth. No, it's that's irrelevant, really.
Was it Glyn Johns who was a real... He loved separating sounds. Someone once told me that if you looked at the broad spectrum of the EQ, he would never have anything that sort of encroached, that was on a similar frequency. He got perfect separation.
Glyn Johns did an interview when I was about 17, and I remember he said he'd done the first two Eagles albums in Barnes at Olympic Studios, and he produced them, and then the third album he got fired halfway through. And he said, it was funny because I thought Desperado was probably... He was fired for it not sounding good enough. And he said, I think Desperado is one of the best records I've ever made. And he said in this interview, he said, it's, in his opinion, your first album you do with a band, it's all exciting, it's all great. And the second album, you know each other and that's fine. Don't do a third album. It's fine. Two albums is enough. And that's a brilliant thing. You know, that's a really... When you have that in your mind as a producer, you don't have all that paranoia of, oh my God, I'm going to get fired. It's like, do two great records, move on, do something else. Fantastic. Mm. But he did a book signing at Olympic Cinema of his autobiography. And I went along thinking, brilliant, we're going to learn some tips here. Some of the greatest records he's made, you know, Joan Armatrading, the Eagles, you know, that they were fantastic records. The only tip I got really was that he made everyone stand in the Ozark Mountain Daredevils. Stand in a line. I was like, okay.
Whilst they're recording?
Yeah, so they'd have the drums and the bass and the guitars all in a line. That was his... I thought...
Facing...
I'm sure there was more to it than that.
And his face was in the control room window.
Yes.
Do you still think there's a place for a band to rehearse and get all the arrangements sorted out and go into somewhere like an Abbey Road Number 2.
Yeah,
studio.
Yeah, absolutely. And great records. Some, you know, like real music is fantastic as well.
Yeah.
But Def Leppard just happened to be one of those producer records. Like 10cc, you know, stuff I used to love back in the day. It's Chico Park by the Small Faces. I stopped producing Def Leppard, or stopped producing anyone in 2000. I did one more album in 2001 with called X, 10. And it was their 9th album. But no, their 10th album.
Yes.
Anyway... I mean, they probably were fed up with me as well, I'd imagine. They couldn't take another day of the bad jokes. And so I was like, right, I'd co-written 4 songs with them, which is great. And I didn't think I could co-write at all, but there was a moment when they were trying to write a lyric and I came up with something. I thought I'd be a songwriter, and I hooked up with a friend called Charlie Grant, who was an upstairs neighbour and wanted to be an artist. And actually, I hooked up with a guy called Richard Kane first, Richard Buckton. And Richard and I worked for about a year and a half trying to get cuts. And then Richard went off to play bass in a band. And I was like, oh, suddenly I'm stuck in the studio. And I'm not a good singer. I don't play guitar. I can program drums. I can play keyboards badly. And I thought, what am I going to do? And Charlie, who I'd worked with and known as an artist for a while, and he's great, an amazing voice, and incredibly talented writer, he said, look, he rang me up. And I was sitting there literally, what am I going to do? Richard's just gone off on tour. He said, look, I've decided I want to try writing. Can I write like you and Richard do? And I was like, well, funnily enough, yeah, that'd be handy. So we wrote a demo of a song and the record company guy liked it. Then we met up with a guy called Nick, who was in what became Rooster. And so we did an album with a band called Rooster, and their first hit, Come Get Some, we wrote. So that was great.
Signs. I caught you looking over with just a little bit of a smile. You tell him that you love him while I'm running through your mind. 'Cause I know that you know your cover will blow. It's only a matter of time. It's not my style to try and cheat and lie. Why do you sanctify something that all